It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, autonomous battlefield weapons get a lot of attention, but our guest says that cyber weapons may actually pose the bigger threat. We'll find out why and what's being done to defend against self-guided cyber weapons. First, the Trump administration approved a $200 million plan submitted by Governor Walker that aims to bring down health care premiums for Wisconsin participants in the Affordable Care Act marketplace. Governor Walker and state lawmakers advanced the plan earlier this year, but they needed a go-ahead from the federal government to implement the program. Walker signed the plan yesterday in Green Bay. It's estimated that what's being called the Wisconsin Healthcare Stability Plan will help bring premiums on the state marketplace down about 3.5%. But there are questions about who the plan will benefit, and some Democrats have said this is just an election year move by Walker. Phil Rocco is an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. He's co-author of the book Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act. Phil, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be here, Rob.
Well, can you talk about who this plan would affect?
So this plan is going to affect anyone who purchases insurance on the individual marketplace. So if you don't receive insurance through your employer, you don't receive it through Medicaid or Medicare, you're purchasing it on the individual insurance marketplace, this is going to affect you.
And is this focused on people who don't get subsidies from the federal government? Because as I understand it, based on your income level, you might be eligible for some kind of subsidies to purchase these marketplace plans.
So what the reinsurance program that Wisconsin's proposed is really going to do is, so reinsurance is insurance for insurers. So it's going to help insurers pay a percentage of the cost of covering really expensive enrollees with a high level of healthcare needs, meaning on an annual level, claims that result in anywhere from $50,000 to $250,000 a year. And so the goal is to make it easier for insurers to enter or remain in the marketplace and lower their premiums, and that's designed to sort of attract healthier individuals to buy insurance, kind of creating a virtuous circle.
Why did we need a federal waiver for Wisconsin to do this?
Well, the ACA has a provision called Section 1332, and what that does is it allows states, which under the ACA are required to have certain kinds of provisions, requirements to cover certain kinds of services, and to design health insurance markets and regulate them in a particular way. One of those provisions requires every individual to be in the marketplace to be in a single risk pool. And so in order to create this reinsurance program, Wisconsin had to waive out of that requirement.
Talking to Phil Rocco from Marquette University about this new reinsurance plan in Wisconsin just approved by the federal government. Phil, let's talk about the problem that this is aimed at solving. What's been happening with premiums for Wisconsin participants in these exchanges?
So it's a really interesting story. So the Walker administration, in advancing its plan, has sort of made the argument that while they're trying to stabilize the marketplace in the ACA, they argue that the ACA is sort of really the problem, that the ACA and its regulations is sort of what caused premiums to be so high in the first place. Now, the problem with that story, it might be true as far as it goes, but the problem with that story is that between 2014 and 2017, in Wisconsin, we actually saw premiums begin to stabilize as insurers started to learn the marketplace. And we saw the number of insurers in the marketplace was growing. But what happened is between 2017 and 2018, sort of just as the debate about repealing the ACA was heating up, around the time that the individual mandate was ultimately repealed, we actually saw premiums spike. And we saw the number of insurers in the individual market drop from 15 down to 11. So, you know, one of the things that's been going on is, you know, certainly it's expensive to enroll individuals, especially who have a high level of healthcare needs. But the political uncertainty around the ACA has made it, in certain ways, kind of unappealing for insurers who are, you know, thinking about making investments. You know, what kind of lines of service are you going to offer? And that level of political uncertainty has probably had something to do with the difficulties the insurers have faced in the marketplace.
This new plan we're talking about is a state effort at reinsurance, as you said, kind of helping insurers hedge against the costs of more expensive customers, basically. Wasn't there supposed to be something like this at the federal level from the beginning?
This was originally part of the ACA. There was a national reinsurance program that lasted for the first few years of the law. And the idea was that in the first few years of the law, you would need reinsurance to make it more appetizing for insurers to come into the market and stay there, and that ultimately, after a few years, insurers would sort of learn the market and competition would ultimately help to drive premiums down and you wouldn't need it anymore. And what happened was that sort of as things rolled out, there was a sort of realization that actually insurers continued to need reinsurance payments for a little bit longer than Congress initially planned, and Republicans who ultimately controlled Congress after the 2010 elections declined to extend the reinsurance program for an additional series of years. So, yes, initially this was something that was envisioned to exist in the ACA sort of at the national level.
Now, this state reinsurance plan, do you think it'll be effective in helping make sure that insurers keep covering in the markets that they've been covering in, and it will help defray the cost, lower the premium cost for Wisconsin consumers?
I think that it's certainly, I think it's really hard to deny that it will have an effect. I think that it will make it more attractive for insurers to come and stay in the marketplace and lower their premiums. I think the question is whether or not, like sometimes when you have to take a not just one pill, but a sort of cocktail of drugs to stay healthy, the question is whether or not this alone will really generate marketplace stability. If you think about it, there are a variety of reasons why insurers might not want to come into the market. One thing that's happened is that Congress has repealed the individual mandate. That's reduced incentives for healthy individuals to insure to enter the marketplace. And so it might be the case that there need to be some more aggressive targeting of those individuals in terms of advertising, other kinds of assistance to help people get into covered. And so I doubt that this alone is going to be the thing that stabilizes the marketplace. And there's a variety of other kinds of reforms, including making it easier for people to enroll, assisting, expanding levels of assistance that people have to enroll because it's kind of complicated. But also, I think that as long as the sort of political controversy over the ACA and its future, it might be worth remembering that Wisconsin is part of a lawsuit that's challenging the constitutionality of the ACA. I think as long as that kind of controversy persists, I think that there's going to be a sort of ceiling on how many insurers decide that it's a valuable, they see the value in investing in the individual marketplace.
Do you see that uncertainty going away anytime soon, given, as you say, the ongoing lawsuit and potentially ongoing efforts in Congress to at least tweak parts of the Affordable Care Act, if not repeal it outright?
I think that's really hard to say. If you think about the situation that Scott Walker is in right now, he's kind of walking, pardon the pun, a tightrope. Right? On the one hand, there is a lot of political support for trying to stabilize the ACA and, you know, as some might say, make it work. On the other hand, the sort of hard right elements within the Republican Party have continued to push for a more radical gutting of the ACA, including through constitutional challenges, as well as sort of additional plans to repeal the law at the federal level. And so I think what's really going to matter is whether or not Republican governors become a sort of active part of the leadership on this issue within the party, basically saying, look, here's what we're up against. This is sort of becoming a more of a political liability for us to sort of have these marketplaces that have these problems. And it'll be interesting to see whether or not governors like Walker sort of take the lead on this issue rather than sort of follow from what really intense policy demanders within the party have wanted.
To be continued, Phil, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
Phil Rocco is an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. He's also co-author of the book Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act. He joined us today to talk about the waiver Governor Walker signed this weekend aimed at lowering costs for Wisconsin participants in the Affordable Care Act marketplace. Right now, there's been a lot of debate about how to regulate autonomous weapons like drones or missiles that work without direct control from humans. Cyber weapons, however, get less attention despite the fact that they can function entirely on their own. Our next guest says they're one of our biggest threats and the U.S. can be doing more to prevent future attacks. Paul Shari is the director of the Technology and National Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. He's the author of the book Army of None, Autonomous Weapons and the Future of War. Paul, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you have this book. It's chock full of stuff that probably scares people, the idea of autonomous predator drones or, you know, Terminator-like cyber soldiers. You say one of the things we should maybe be most worried about isn't the physical stuff. It's autonomous cyber weapons. Why should we be worried?
Well, we're seeing really incredible advances in cyberspace. And I think that we tend to focus on the physical things, the drones, the robotic vehicles. They're more tangible, they're more visible. But cyberspace is everywhere. Cyberspace has colonized our world. It's all of our digital systems on our desktops, in our cars, in our pockets. It controls the electrical grid. And there's incredible vulnerabilities in all of these digital systems. They're all vulnerable to cyber attacks. And we're seeing autonomy and automation get more incorporated into these as militaries and governments are moving forward with some of this technology. So we've seen really interesting advances. There was an attack a couple years ago called Stuxnet on Iranian centrifuge operations involved in Iranian nuclear enrichment that was very autonomous. It was designed to operate on a closed network that was not connected to the internet. And so the software that was Stuxnet, this piece of malware that went to go sabotage Iranian systems, had to operate entirely on its own without humans remotely controlling it. And we're seeing more advances on the defensive side as well. A few years ago, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, DARPA, sponsored a grand challenge in cyberspace that had computers automatically hacking other computers. And so this is another area where both offensively and defensively, really incredible gains going forward in autonomous cyber weapons.
Talk a little more about how this works, because I think a lot of people, I'll include myself, when we think of cybersecurity, we think of a hacker, a human sitting at a computer, you know, somewhere on the planet trying to penetrate a network. As you say, these are autonomous. What does that mean? How do they work?
So most of the time, it is a human today. Now, one of the things that people are very interested in is enabling the machines to do more actions all on their own. Just the same way that people are programming cars to be more autonomous and drive on their own. One of the advantages to having more automation in cyberspace is there are huge human capital shortfalls. There just aren't enough hackers. And one of the consequences of this is that there's a lot of computer insecurity. People aren't checking computer software to see if there are vulnerabilities. So just like a hacker could go in and hack something offensively and exploit it, manipulate their way into a system, in order to test a system for bugs, you need a hacker who does that defensively, who can go through the software and see whether there are any bugs or exploits in there. Well, in this project a couple years ago that DARPA did, their Cyber Grand Challenge, people brought together computers that could do this. They looked for known kinds of vulnerabilities inside software, and then they'd scan them and see if they could find them all on their own. And they were engaging in a competition. On the offensive side, they tried to exploit these bugs and find a way into another computer. Defensively, they were trying to protect their own computer networks. And they found that they were pretty good at this. Not better than the top human hackers in the world, but probably in the top 20. That's pretty good and pretty useful. And so one of the things that people are excited about is that this might be a way to offset these shortfalls in human capital, the lack of hackers, and it would help change the current dynamic where right now most computer software that's put out on the market is not been thoroughly tested. It's like getting a house full of locks on all of the doors, but no one's checked to make sure that these locks actually work. With these automated tools, they can go through and they can check all the locks.
Okay, that seems like the upside. We can train computers and software to go through and find vulnerabilities
to plug them, but it seems like it would be equally possible to train a computer or software to find these vulnerabilities and exploit them.
Yeah, of course, there's a dark side to this technology as well, and that's one of the things that that I often worry about in my job. So we're, you know, the challenge with computer security is the technology is inherently dual use. So if you find a bug, if you find an exploit in a computer, you can patch it, or you can exploit that vulnerability and find a way to manipulate your way into the system. And so the exact same technology can do either one. Software is not like physical systems. It's very easily copied and then interchangeable and reused by others. So whereas if, you know, for something like a car has a problem, maybe there's a problem in the braking system, it's not that easy for someone else to just copy that and replicate. You can't rebuild a whole automobile. But if you get a piece of software, someone can copy that, download that to the computer, a hacker can manipulate that, and they can use this for their own purposes. And we've seen this kind of approach, this open source malware approach being used to then copy malware and reuse it, creating botnets that spread across the internet. And so that's another significant problem, is all of this technology will be used offensively and copied by others to create automated tools that then exploit vulnerabilities out on the internet.
Talking to Paul Shari, Director of the Technology and National Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. He's the author of the book, Army of None, Autonomous Weapons and the Future of War. We're talking about autonomous cyber weapons. So, Paul, I don't want to scare everybody out there, but what kind of things worry you if somebody could dump, say, in the United States, these autonomous cyber weapons? Where do you think a lot of damage could be done?
You know, certainly the most frightening things are things that involve what security analysts would call critical infrastructure: nuclear power plants, water treatment facilities, electrical grids. You know, we brought these things online in the past couple of years, but with these come some vulnerabilities. And in fact, the Department of Homeland Security released last year that we know that Russia had infiltrated many of these critical infrastructure facilities. And, you know, we don't know what they were planning on doing, but it looks like they were snooping around, doing what looks like early reconnaissance, and potentially planting some seeds that they could go back later in a conflict. And if they wanted, they could actually sabotage these systems. Now, this is another nation state. They're fairly advanced in their capabilities. This isn't, you know, contrary to what the president might say, this isn't the kind of thing that somebody in a garage might be able to do or somebody in their basement. But one of the fears is that if you got into a major conflict, a country like Russia could really use this to cause quite a bit of damage. And we've seen at least a proof of concept in this with the cyber weapon Stuxnet that I mentioned earlier that targeted Iranian centrifuge operations, and that it was the first cyber weapon to cross this digital to physical divide, that it wasn't just manipulating ones and zeros. It actually started doing that, and then it used it to physically damage the centrifuge operations. So if someone could do that same thing, get into the control center of a nuclear power plant or a water treatment facility or electrical grids, that could, of course, be very, very damaging. Now, no one knows in practice how feasible this is. One of the good things is that our networks in the United States, our electrical grid, for example, is very decentralized. So what would be the consequences of a massive cyber attack? We just really don't know, but we'd also rather not find out.
Is there any kind of effort at arms control for state actors developing these kind of weapons?
There have been attempts. Countries have been coming together for the past decade or so, talking about cyber norms, rules of the road in cyberspace. The problem is that countries are happy to come together and say nice things are on the negotiating table, but then secretly they're still conducting these kinds of attacks and these kinds of sabotage operations. And one of the first things that was put on the table is, well, not targeting other countries' critical infrastructure. And we know that Russia's already done that. You know, it's not clear that these conversations are going to go anywhere constructively when we've seen Russia, for example, engage in these kinds of reconnaissance operations against critical infrastructure. And then, of course, attacks against the U.S. election system And we've seen now very recently the indictment by Robert Mueller of Russian military intelligence officers involved in hacks against the U.S. Election system. And so, you know, it's hard to say, you know, when you have very clear lines and you say these are the things we're not going to cross, and then Russia does that, it's hard to know where what the value is in further conversations.
Briefly, as we wrap up, I mean, the genie is out of the bottle. This is a really cheap way and often a deniable way to interfere with an adversary. Why not do it compared to the cost of, say, a warship or a bomber?
You know, ultimately, what's going to stop an actor is going to be the fear of what someone might do in response. Deterrence is what's going to stop someone. Is that the reason why another country won't launch a missile or start a war is because the U.S. has a large military and they know that we might respond. And similarly, if other countries are actually going to be deterred from future attacks, the United States has to respond accordingly. And this is a case where when it comes to Russia and attacks against the U.S. election, the United States has been very, very weak in its response. And a lot of security analysts have said, if we want to stop Russia from doing this again, and we know that there are already some places where in the run-up to the midterms they've been targeting certain political candidates, then we have to be more forceful and send a clear message that we're not going to tolerate that, and then if Russia continues to do this, they're going to pay a price.
Paul, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Paul Shari is the author of the book Army of None, Autonomous Weapons and the Future of War. He talked to us about the threat that cyber weapons pose and what's being done to stop them. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Steve Gotcher.
When most people hear the words wood tick, they usually race in the other direction. But there's a place in northern Wisconsin where it's the ticks that do the racing. Michelle Good went to check it out.
Hi. Is this the registration desk?
Yeah. By insects.
I'm at North Country's Hardwood Cafe in Loretta, Wisconsin, about halfway between Park Falls and Hayward. And I'm staring at a stack of little takeout condiment cups, each one with a wood tick inside. I will never look at tartar sauce the same way again.
I didn't realize you could... You buy the tick?
Yes, you can buy the tick for $1, or you can bring your own and you just have to pay to register it.
I'm Terry.
Terry.
Okay, my name is Tic Tac.
Okay, there was one more, was ya?
That's Doug.
Doug.
Your tick's name is?
Jezebel.
Jezebel?
Where did you find it?
Just walk outside.
Heck yeah.
Just walk
all
over. Just look at them all over here.
And it's much more competitive than you would expect.
There was a guy there that I was talking to. He got a tick off his dog, and he took it off for a couple of days. Then he would put it on for a couple of days and take it off for a couple of days.
So yeah. Training regimen.
Yes.
It's the steroids. It's tick racing.
Thank everybody for coming to Raven Susie's to keep the wood tick racing tradition in order. First two ticks are Waylon and Tristan. Two on deck are Speedy and French Tickler. Waylon and Christine, are we ready?
Oh my God, so they plop them down.
And they're off.
You know whose is whose?
Yeah, that's yours.
Oh, that's going to win.
Come on. Oh, here it goes. Oh, boy.
Christine is fast.
Waylon's drunk.
Waylon's just walking in his
circle. He hasn't even got out of circles.
There, now you're going the right way.
Christine's nearly back to where she started.
Just get mine out of the circle.
He's still in the circle.
Just get out of the circle.
Oh, Christine's making a move. Oh, no, she's going back to help Waylon. Not sure where to go.
This is the longest race in the history of music.
Oh, and there's one dead tick. Oh my God, there's a loose one.
Did somebody pick their winning tick up? Speedy, we're looking for Speedy.
But these people are not in control. You don't want to mix alcohol and ticks. I just have to say that for the record. Okay, they said a couple years ago it was like 120.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We had quite a few.
We had quite a few. I mean, the bar was absolutely
hard to wrangle that many ticks.
Right.
Yeah.
But a dollar entry, winner takes all, so you usually walk away about $45, $50.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Big
nice
time.
Saturday.
Big money. Big money in the Northwood. A couple beers.
Yeah. Can't go wrong.
Yep. I mean, what else are you going to do right before the holiday weekend, Dan? You know? So it's always something to do. We always have fun up here.
They certainly do. After 3.5 hours of racing and 42 dead ticks, Scott Scooter Smith of New Richmond took home the trophy with his tick, Bloodsucker.
Michelle Good grew up in the Northwoods and is the host of Chapter a Day. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Steve Gotcher.
This is Central Time. Now, discussions about animal rights and animal welfare can be divisive, but our next guest says we can take a balanced approach to our relationships with animals in all communities of our lives, whether we're talking about pets in our homes, meat on our plates, or animals in the wild. He says we need to think about our cultural, ethical, and legal connections with animals with the concept of respect front and center. David Favor is a professor of law at the Michigan State University College of Law. He's written several books about animals and law and is a founding officer of the Animal Legal Defense Fund. His newest book is Respecting Animals, A Balanced Approach to Our Relationship with Pets, Food, and Wildlife. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, what does it mean, big picture, before we dig into some specific examples, to have more respect for the animals in our lives?
It is a matter of being aware of them as individuals, and respecting them means that you take into account who they are and what their needs are.
And you approach this in the book from an ethical standpoint and a legal standpoint, and let's talk about the ethics side of things. You talk about animals as being entities that we need to think about in ethical terms.
That's correct. My approach is kind of basic, and that is they are living beings on this planet, just like we are living beings. And I think that it does us good as ethical beings to take into account the existence, and when we have impacts on others, that the word others should include animals and not just people.
And I think, and you write that a lot of times people go to a zero or everything mindset. Either there's no such thing as a right or an ethical expectation for an animal, or if you start thinking of animals in those terms, you are quickly in a place where animals have the same ethical responsibility or ethical protections or rights as a human. You say there's someplace in between.
That's correct. Yes, I think we have to acknowledge that humans are really in charge of this earth and that we can't treat them as equals. Obviously, very few animals have anywhere near our capacities or interest. They don't really care about democracies or freedom of speech or anything like that, or the right to vote. What they want is simply a reasonably good life under our care.
And you spend time defining the idea of a community of humans and animals and different ways of thinking of the ways we exist in communities with animals. Can you spell that out for us?
Yes. One of the other problems in thinking about animals is that a number of people think that a particular animal should have the same expectations regardless of where physically it's found. And I think that this is not helpful. It means well, but it's not helpful because just like we treat humans ethically depending upon what community we share with them, I think the animals should be in the same position, that their ethics, our ethics towards the animals will be derived from the community that we coexist in.
Let's look at some concrete examples, and let's start with probably the animal people interact with the most in their daily lives, their pets. When we think about our pets in terms of respect, how does that affect the care we give them?
Well, I think in today's world, in the United States in particular, that community is the family community, and that as a member, when you let them in, when you adopt them, which is a term we use, of course, for children first, but now we're using it for animals too, that shows in and of itself, the word adoption means bringing you into the responsibility of the family. And if you take that seriously, then you must understand that your dog, cat, or other animal has its own personality, its own needs, species needs, and individual needs, and you're not carrying out your obligations if you don't let that animal be itself.
We're talking to law professor David Favor, author of the new book, Respecting Animals, A Balanced Approach to Our Relationship with Pets, Food, and Wildlife. And let's get into the food portion of things, David. Some people, obviously some vegetarians and vegans say, well, if we're treating animals with respect, we, by definition, can't eat them. Is it possible to have animals re-raised for food and yet have this condition of respect for them?
I think it is, although not in our present food system. The industrial food system we now have is totally disrespectful of the animals in the system, so please don't think I'm supporting that at all. But I have seen enough family farms where the animals and the humans share the farm, and they know the individual animals, and the animals are respected. They're given their needs, and they have a reasonably good life. And then to support that farm and that life, they do become food for humans.
Yeah, you distinguish in your book between traditional agricultural animal raising and industrial animal raising. Why? And you say that that personal contact between the human and the animal is one of the distinguishing characteristics.
Yes, I think that's very important. This comes primarily because I started raising commercial animals myself in the form of sheep and chickens. And it is, if you're the owner of the animal and you walk around and you see that animal and you look it in the eye and it looks you in the eye, I think that inherently creates a level of responsibility, a recognition that this is a being and that I am responsible for that being. And in these industrial facilities where the chickens, there's 10,000 chickens in one building, no human ever looks in the eye of this animal, certainly not the owner. And so it just results in terrible conditions for the animals because nobody cares.
Now, we heard from Ellen on the Ideas Network Facebook page. She says, I enjoy getting proteins from several sources, but I really enjoy animal meats and products made for them. They have room to grow, are not mistreated, are attended to in a respectful manner, and are well-fed and have available water and have shelter from the sun and harsh elements. But another Facebook user, Andrew, says the actual killing of the animal could be seen as mistreatment in and of itself, regardless of the conditions that led up to that point. What do you think, David?
I think that is indeed the most difficult of the questions, and that is it respectful? Is that moment of death respectful? And in one way it isn't, and another way it is. I understand the people who make the claim that there shouldn't be any death. I would just suggest you, if you don't have that death, then the animal isn't going to be able to exist on the farm from a commercial reality point of view. It simply is a necessity, and I'd rather look at and believe that it is that one day of death is counterbalanced with all the days, months, and so forth of a good life.
We're talking to David Favor, professor of law at the Michigan State University College of Law. He's talking to us about his new book, Respecting Animals, A Balanced Approach to Our Relationship with Pets, Food, and Wildlife. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What does ethical use of treatment and treatment of animals mean to you? Do you think that you treat animals with respect in your life? Do you think we as humans do that in general? What kind of legal protections should there be for animals? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up that conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up the conversation with David Favor, professor of law at Michigan State University, looking at his new book, Respecting Animals, A Balanced Approach to Our Relationship with Pets, Food, and Wildlife. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What kind of ethical responsibility do you think we have for pets, for animals raised for food or work animals, for animals in a circus or a zoo, for animals in the wild? And what kind of legal protections do you want to see for those different animals in different places? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. David, let's turn to that legal side of things. In practice, there are protections for animals that do stop short of recognizing them as fully legal entities like, a human.
Oh, yes, absolutely. This idea of respect is pretty fully fleshed out in our criminal code. When you talk about the anti-cruelty laws, the duty of care sections of those in all 50 states put a pretty high bar of veterinary care and food and water, exercise, and not being subjected to the elements and to other negative events. The problem with that criminal law is that it exempts food animals and animals in scientific research. So some communities of animals aren't covered by those criminal laws, but the companion animal clearly is, and it does a fairly good job of setting out what respect for use means.
Do you think we should be reconsidering our laws when it comes to food animals and research animals?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, we need a major rethink on the food animals in particular. Scientific use of animals is a little bit more complex because there really are some positive things happening there, and so it's hard to balance, but that's a conversation worth having too.
Let's go to our callers now. Jim is with us in Milwaukee. Jim, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to bring up, Jim?
Well, I used to live up in...
Okay. Emergency vehicles passing up the gym. Yeah, it sounds a little better now.
They're blown by me, yep. Anyway, I used to live in northern Wisconsin, and we had all kinds of animals, steers and raccoons and squirrels and dogs, chickens and whatever, and we named them all, and they were all fed and watered and cared for, and with that, the chickens usually ended up in the freezer, and the steers ended up in the freezer, but they were named, and they were petted and loved and cared for right up until the time that we processed them for our needs.
Jim, thanks for the call. Jump in before another emergency vehicle goes by there. David, what do you think of that? All the animals were named, Jim says, cared for, and it sounds like he feels pretty good about his connection with those animals.
Well, that is generally what I'm trying to aim us towards, yes, absolutely. And giving an animal a name is a definite human aspect of showing respect and acknowledgement of individuality among the animals. So I think that's a nice thing.
How do we make sure, David, that, or is this possible, that we're not treating them in human terms that are in ways that are at odds with how they'd want to be treated, if we could say that, as animals? Are we putting human terms on things that don't want them?
We do have to be careful about that. I've seen people do some very strange things for animals that I'm pretty sure the animal did not necessarily think was a good idea. I think that comes with what science can tell us nowadays, and science really can tell us quite a bit about the nature of animals, both as a species and then the repertoire that's available within that particular group of animals. So dogs, I think now we know quite a bit about, and if somebody cares to figure it out, they'll find out what it is they need for their own particular dog.
Jim, thanks for that call. Go next to Jonathan in Sharon. Jonathan, hi.
How's it going?
Good. What do you think?
I guess what I think is that I think that in this country we have a huge disconnection with our food system, and I think that or where our food comes from, and that skews our understanding of the animal's role in a diverse ecosystem, and they play such a vital role in maintaining healthy soil, like, you know, ruminants, chickens and animals like that, and there's many cases throughout history of cultures having a very respectful relationships with animals that are helping them, and I think that we've kind of lost this sense of having that mutual relationship where we're building fertility in the land but then also surviving off of it.
David, what do you think?
I absolutely agree. And that's one of the points in my book, is that when we talk about farm animals, not only is it interesting to the human to have that relationship, but to the environment as well. It's pasture land that allows the wildlife to coexist alongside of us in the natural areas, particularly here in the Midwest, whereas acres and acres and thousands of acres of cornfield do nothing for wildlife, nothing whatsoever. And so the quality of life, both for the environment and for ourselves and for the animals, are better matched in the community farming that has historical roots.
Jonathan, thanks for the call. We're talking to David Favor. His new book is called Respecting Animals. Back to your calls. James is with us in Milwaukee. James, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm wondering what David's opinion is. We've been talking about keeping animals in cages and the ethics of that. And I was wondering what he thinks about keeping children locked up at the border. How does that relate to how we think of other human beings as animals when Trump demonizes them?
So can we make analogies, David, between locking up humans and locking up animals?
Absolutely. That is disrespectful of the children in a much higher degree, I think, than it is even with animals, because humans are so much more complex, and that cage is much more interfering with what is good for the particular human involved. So, yeah, absolutely. You got to watch it, whether it's a lion or a child or an iguana, cages can be extremely disrespectful.
We'll go next to Kirk on the line in Wisconsin Dells. Kirk, hello.
Hi, just a brief aside to the previous comment. If I remember my history correctly, the origins of the SPCA here in America were the first docents of children's advocacy in the workplace. Now, to my comment, I recently came from California, now living here in central Wisconsin. I'm aware that the dairy industry is roughly a $20 billion, with a B, Carl Sagan units, industry per year in the state of Wisconsin. Question, how long before we start to talk about and realize the necessity of separating mass wealth extraction from basic animal rights? I'll take my answer off the air.
Kirk, thanks for the call. David, what do you think? Animal welfare, animal rights versus a business model?
That is a problem. That is one of the major problems in the United States and the world, as far as that goes, and that is the disconnect between treating animals as individuals and them as simply a commodity for further profit. Our corporate world seems to be driven by need for efficiency, and efficiency usually means cutting back and treating things as uniform as possible. And that's not what we need for animals. We need some recognition of them as individuals. And it's inefficient, and it will produce it may produce a higher cost for commercial animals if we go that route, but I think that's simply something we have to pay.
Kirk, thanks for that call. David, I know you're trying to raise a lot of questions, get us talking about animals. Are we all going to end up with the same answers?
Well, no, I'm pretty sure that's not going to happen, knowing human beings and how diverse this is. But one of the issues is, you know, when somebody talks about things, you bring your cultural history, your family history, your religious views. There's so much of human's nature that comes into play when we start talking about animals. So it would be quite a while before we all got to the same point. But an example where we have socially got to the same point is dogfighting. Dogfighting used to be available just about everywhere, and it still is available every now and then. But we, as a society, we have decided, we have a mutual consent that dogfighting is unethical and therefore illegal to do in the United States. I think other issues are also susceptible to that decision-making process, but it takes time.
Do you think that the bar is going to be raised to have wider definitions, more protections for animals?
Oh, absolutely. The arc is clearly towards more awareness and protection for animals.
We'll leave it there. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We've been talking to David Favor. He's a professor of law at the Michigan State University College of Law. He joined us today to talk about his new book. It's called Respecting Animals, A Balanced Approach to Our Relationship with Pets, Food, and Wildlife. There's still time for you to share your thoughts, maybe your experiences, your stories. You can join the conversation on the Ideas Network Facebook page. What do you think about ethics and our responsibility to animals, pets, food in the wild and beyond? Here's a warning today from someone at the National Transportation Safety Board that you may not have known you needed. Here it is. I'm quoting, "Motor vehicle crashes are the leading cause of death in the U.S. Hopping out of a moving vehicle or jumping into lanes of traffic to show your dance moves is foolish and dangerous to you and those around you." What? The NTSB is responding to this thing online, the so-called In My Feelings Challenge. This is a song by Drake, and as things sometimes do, somebody came up with a bad idea and tried to make it go viral on the internet. The concept is people are hopping out of a moving car and being videoed dancing in the streets. So clearly a bad idea. I'm hoping this is one of those things that isn't happening as much as they make it out to be. Like, it turned out the Tide Pod Challenge. Nobody was actually, as far as I can tell, actually swallowing detergent packets. But clearly there are cases, some people have done this, some people have been hit and injured by cars. So we're bringing up the song by Drake here. I cannot emphasize this strongly enough. If you are driving, remain in your car while you listen. Maybe nod your head, tap the steering wheel, go no further. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Girl,